We are joined now by a guest. We're so happy he could be with us. We're going to be talking about wild and edible, which aren't words that always go together well, but in plenty of cases they do. Just ask anyone who's ever enjoyed gourmet mushrooms or a bounty of blackberries on a smoky summer afternoon. Our guest today has long chronicled common items on Mother Nature's menu. He holds a PhD in nutrition, a master's in education, and a bachelor's in zoology. He's been studying wild foods for 45 years, and his Portland-based company, Wild Food Adventures, is in its 22nd year. He is the author of Wild Edible Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate, and he joins us on the line in advance of a September 2nd speaking appearance at Eugene Public Library. Dr. John Kalis, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure to be here.
We're so glad you could join us. So you have a guidebook out there. We just mentioned the title of it, Wild Edible Plants from Dirt to Plate. It doesn't read like a traditional botanical field guide. How did you approach this topic differently?
Well, most field guides that are out there are written like book catalogs. So, for instance, you have your Sears catalog, which shows, you know, clothes, and I don't know if they still do it, in fact, but, you know, where you give a little bit of summary information, one picture, and that's it. And wild plants are different in many respects, particularly for the learner, because what you have to, I'm sorry?
Oh, I was just going to ask in what respects they're different, but it sounds like that's where you're headed.
Yeah. Well, when you go to the supermarket to buy food, everything has been done for you, and the food is just sort of wrapped and ready to use. Well, when you're trying to gather wild foods, you have to take the place of the farmer. You have to take the place of the botanist who originally, you know, came up with the food. You have to do all the things ahead of time, the food processor. You're responsible for the plant identification. So that puts you in a whole different light. You need to know a little bit more. So when the farmer is harvesting celery, for instance, they know exactly when it's at its prime. So when you are out there, you have to know when that dandelion is at its prime. And there are several ways, you know, to figure things like that out. And you know, what's the condition of the soil? How much rain or moisture has been in the soil? How lushly that dandelion is growing? You know, so a lot of people, when they just hear dandelions are edible, which is what most of the catalog kind of books tell you, and that's it. You go out, you find the first dandelion that you see, you grab it. That's not going to be very good because a lot of times it's growing amongst grass and the grass is competing with it for moisture and nutrients, so it's struggling. So the leaves are growing slowly and the sun is baking those leaves and, you know, you eat those and they're so bitter you have to, like, boil them three times in order to make them palatable. Well, if you knew what you were doing, you would be finding the dandelions that were somewhere near your garden or somewhere near where some things were being watered, and those dandelions would be growing lushly. Rapid growth, that's really where the edibility is with dandelions. And so those things are not explained to you in most of the books. That's what I do differently. My book is like a user manual rather than a plant catalog.
I see. So a field guide. I like that, a user manual. And it sounds like not everything edible is edible all the time. We're talking with John Kalis, Director of Wild Food Adventures in Portland. You can join the discussion 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org with your comments and questions about foraging. Now, John, your book, we were just talking about how it sort of stands apart, your wild edible plants, more of a user's guide than a typical plant field guide. There's an organizational strategy in there, too. It's organized by flavor. How'd you go about doing that?
Well, when again, we're no longer an agrarian society where, you know, there's only like a small percentage of people that are actually on the farms anymore. And so when we choose food, when we go to the supermarket, we're choosing by flavor and purpose. And so I figured, well, you know, that's one reason to choose by flavor, because that's how a lot of people choose foods to begin with. But also, if you're eating things for the first time, you want to have a heads up on, you know, what are the flavors going to be like. And so if, for instance, the four basic categories that I divided the first book into, second book will have some more categories, but the first book has foundational foods, bitter foods, sour or tart, and pungent. Those are the four different categories. So if people are sort of timid about beginning to start this process, they can start with the foundational foods, which are just sort of, they've got a nice flavor. Everybody likes them, like lettuce or spinach or things like that. They sort of have a mild flavor and could work pretty much in any kind of a recipe. And then as you get more adventurous, you can try, you know, the pungent ones and the sour ones and the bitter ones. Or if you love bitter, you know, you've got a whole chapter of bitter greens.
So picky eaters, that's a pretty common thing in our society, perhaps partly a symptom of having so many choices. Even when we're talking about these foods that are forageable, that are foundational, that are, you know, pretty run-of-the-mill, or maybe not run-of-the-mill flavors, but the flavors wouldn't cause offense to most taste buds. Do you still have friends or family, people that you know, who refuse to sample foods simply because they've been found out in the world?
Yeah, I think there's a huge misunderstanding about wild foods. All wild foods are traditional foods. They're either, in this country, they're either traditional Native American foods if they're found, you know, if they're native plants, or if they're considered weeds here, they're traditional European wild foods. And everybody, you know, before we had big cities, everybody ate wild foods. There's no exceptions to that. So these are normal foods. It's just that we've gotten used to eating things out of the supermarket. So a lot of people, in fact, I just got criticized on Amazon because my book wasn't a survival book. You know, it's sort of like wild foods have been relegated to this thing. Well, if it's only you're only interested in wilderness survival, but you know, no, these are like normal traditional foods. You don't need them. You know, if you're out there with Bear Grylls, you know, trying to survive, no, you these are normal things. When I eat wild foods, they're in my omelet. They're, you know, in my stir fry. It's just normal foods that we've lost touch with.
And are there wild foods, traditional foods? You say all foods started out this way. Part of me, I want to ask for some specific examples of wild foods that have been co-opted into a mainstream distribution, things you might see at the supermarket that actually people are foraging and collecting them and putting them there.
I'm sorry, what's your question?
What kind of wild foods have been co-opted by a distribution that's not wild? Say, I'm thinking of chanterelles in the supermarket, that sort of thing, where people don't bat an eye if it's in a package.
Well, yeah, everything that we eat was once wild. So that's why I guess I didn't understand the question.
At the heart of it is when did wild food go out of style, and is it coming back?
Oh, well, it went out of style between World War I and World War II. You know, at first it was just, you know, it's less convenient, you know, because now, you know, regular stores were starting to sell food and people could live in the cities and things like that. But I think during World War II, when we started wrapping everything in plastic, and there was this sort of upwardly mobile cultural thing that went on, people stopped viewing wild foods as a necessary addition for variety and flavor and things like that. and started looking at it as a poor man's food. And so it sort of lost this normalness. And then, you know, and I remember my mom used to tell me, you know, my grandfather came from Greece, and he knew and ate lots of wild foods on a regular basis. And so, you know, he would be driving here in the United States with my mom in the car as a little kid, and he would see a wild food in a field in perfect condition, and he would stop the car, get out, and she would be hiding in the car, hoping that her friends did not see her with her dad who was out there picking wild foods.
A sort of a mark of poverty.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. He didn't see it that way at all, but she did. And so, you know, I think that's when it was really sort of a low point, until a fellow named Yul Gibbons came along and wrote the book Stalking the Wild Asparagus. That was the first of his three books way back in the
60s. What a great title.
Yeah, and he repopularized it and sort of made it sort of a popular thing again amongst the outdoor crowd, because that was when Earth Day was first coming around, and, you know, we started having environmental awareness and all that, and so he started to raise the popularity of it.
So for me, I am curious about wild edible foods, but I feel a lot more comfortable actually eating them if I've got company, you know, somebody with me who I can check in with about 12 hours later. How do you recommend people connect with other foraging enthusiasts in their area?
Well, you know, when I first got started, there was no internet. And now there are all sorts of groups on the web. You know, if you just search for wild foods, you know, on Facebook and other things, you can find groups that are talking about this stuff all the time. And of course, you know, you can do searches on Google, but the problem is that it's sort of random information, and you don't know what's good and what's not. So for instance, even if you type in a plant in Google under the image part, it'll show you all sorts of images. And sometimes they'll be the right plant, and sometimes they won't. So, you know, you really, it's pretty tough right now. There's no sort of verifying entity on the web that says, no, that's not really the plant you think you have. So that's why it's good to have an expert, if you can, identifying things for you, or have a book that really shows you the detail. And one of the other features, you mentioned that one of the features of my book was to plants in categories by flavor. But the other thing, the reason it's called Dirt to Plate, that's the subtitle, wild, Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate, is I've got plants from seedling through every stage of growth, including close-ups of the edibles at their prime for gathering. So there's no mistake in terms of what you're seeing, what you're identifying, and what your goal is to take into your kitchen with you.
John Kalis, do you have a wild food that's really surprised you by how delicious it can be, maybe even how unexpectedly delicious it can be?
Yeah, there's a few like that. There is a plant called oxeye daisy that has leaves that have, they're in the foundational group, which is, you know, the sort of the nice flavored plants. That don't have any bitterness or pungency or whatever. And it's got this really nice, sweet flavor. And there's also Saskatoon berries, which, and this isn't every plant. And one of the things I tell my students is, you know, nature's not here for our convenience. You know, so we have to sort of live with what it gets us. But some plants, some Saskatoon berry plants, it's also known as Juneberry, is another name for that plant, are so sweet when they sort of dry on the tree or on the shrub, they taste like candy. I mean, they're just amazingly good. But that's not every one of those plants. Because every plant, which is few people know this, is an individual genetically, just like we're all genetic individuals. And so some of them, some plants within the same species will have amazing flavor, and other ones will just be normal.
So a big world out there with a lot of variety in wild edible food flavors, perhaps more than we find in the grocery store. We've been talking today with John Kalis, PhD, Director of Wild Food Adventures and the Institute for the Study of Edible Wild Plants and Other Forageables. His book, Wild Edible Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate, is out in paperback. He'll be at Eugene Public Library on September 2nd. Thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.